So, good day, afternoon. Can you hear me okay? Is the volume okay? The theme for this retreat, as I said, is the transformation of the three defilements of greed, ill will, and delusion into confidence, wisdom, and equanimity. These defilements are also known as the three poisons or impurities. Today I'm going to speak pr mainly about greed and desire and how it can transform into confidence and faith, into trust. Desire is an inclusive term. It includes both the helpful and the unhelpful desires we have. Many of the desires we have are actually really useful and very important in our lives. Sometimes in spiritual circles, there can be a tendency to view all desire as a problem, but it still keeps us surviving. It's only a problem when we cling to it. The survival of the entire human race depends on the desires for food, for shelter, for physical contact, for sex. The desire for awakening is essential for the Buddhist path. So desire can be a healthy thing that we experience. But when we cling to any of our desires and they become a craving, and any craving of any kind causes us suffering on some level. It might be hard to see sometimes how the craving for just one more thing to look at in our device, that's causing us suffering, that tension we feel in that moment. But if we look carefully enough, we see that tension, that the lack of peace inside of us. It's pretty easy to see that when we cling to desire for food, what happens? It becomes gluttony. We make ourselves sick overeating, or we eat foods that are really harmful to us. We cling to desire for shelter. It can become the desire for a fortress, for security, and so we're always become afraid of losing it. When we cling to desire for sex, it can turn into many harmful sexual behaviors. In my very early practice, I found myself, it was really easy to recognize aversion. I saw everything that was wrong with everything, with myself, with my environment, especially with other people, and with the world. And I thought, well, just during meditation, desire just doesn't come up for me. I thought, well, I never think about food while I'm meditating. And except for very long retreats, I didn't think about sex. And I wasn't materialistic, except for my devices, of course. But I didn't think about those during meditation. But it turned out, as I kept paying attention, that I didn't recognize the many faces of desire and greed. I still remember my very first retreat. I got there really early so I could get the best seat in the hall. And and I also, I got there really early and made sure I had the yogi job I wanted. Kind of manipulated my way into that one. I wanted to be a veggie chopper, And of course I wanted the comfort of sitting by the open window. I wanted the fresh air. Then as the retreat went on, and the yogi that sat in front of me, boy, she was a good yogi. She could just sit still for hour after hour. And I wanted to be just like her. Didn't recognize desire coming up, right? Comparing mind. And the food line, I looked around, what are the yogis doing? What are they doing? Okay, I better don't take as much food as I want because I want to look good. I want to look good. And didn't recognize any of those desires. And then, you know, once I settled into meditation, my mind began to settle, and you know, it was pretty peaceful, and things seemed to be moving really well. But I wanted to have a better experience, something, oh, I wanted to be stronger, something to write home about. And so, you know, these are the desires that show up. You know, we all have our different flavors of them. You know, there's the very obvious ones like comfort and money and pleasure, you know, but there's so many flavors of our attachments. You know, just think back to your day today. Have you had any craving for comfort? You know, have you had any craving for pleasure? Maybe for excess food? Or maybe wanting a sitting to be over or for the bell to ring? So any of those, you know, those are the desires that show up. Deeply understanding desire is a central part of insight practice. It's rare for humans to just be. Mostly we want, we're run by desires. We go from one to the next. I really liked when Gill said that instead of human beings, we should call ourselves human desirelings. You know, desires can range from the very subtle to the gross. You know, as we've been sitting here, you know, how many of us have shifted already to be more comfortable? And some of it even unconsciously, or maybe move the hair out of the face, or shifting the back. You know, all those movements come from desire. And some of them are useful. You know, if the hair's, you know, sitting in our mouth, let's remove it. But without mindfulness, we can go from one to the next, one desire to the next all day long, just following that forward pool of desires. And we satisfy one, you know, we have a good meal, then time for a new one. You know, maybe we want to be entertained. Maybe we want social contact. Maybe we want this. You know, I remember sitting on a plane, you know, for a few hours, you know, and I needed to take a, you know, really much needed break, you know, and which is a really healthy desire in a plane, right? You want to get up and move. But just when I'm about to stand up, there's turbulence and they tell us to put on our seatbelts and not get up. And my desire was frustrated. You know, I became unhappy and grumpy. And just waiting and waiting until I could get up and stretch. And probably took it out of the relative sitting next to me. You know, but this is unmet desire. What happens with when desire is unmet? You know, or maybe, you know, at a different point in my practice, I was able to stay aware of desire that couldn't be met. And I noticed that it was unpleasant. And I relaxed into that. You know, it's a peace with it. Okay, I didn't get to get up. I'm really uncomfortable. This is very unpleasant. And but it's a very different internal experience. Now, the first step in working with greed is to recognize when it's present. You know, when we're caught up, when are we caught up in wanting? Is it there? And, you know, I'll mention some of these, a few of these things, you know, and, you know, see if anything resonates with you that might, you know, might make you a little more aware of the different forms of desire in your life. You know, some are very obvious, like addiction, you know, like drugs and alcohol, smoking, gambling, sex, food can all be addictive. And most addictions cause damage in our lives. You know, we can have greed for money or for material things. You know, we see it at play in our world with a massive amount of consumption. Not only with overflowing garbage dumps, but do any of you have overflowing garages? You know, and it's the accumulation of stuff, you know, and we often don't see that. Some of you, she was, for some reason, she wasn't as famous as she might have been, but there was a woman called Peace Pilgrim. I don't know if any of you have heard of her, but this is back in the 50s. You know, she was 45, and she gave up her name and all her possessions to become Peace Pilgrim. And for 28 years, she walked across the US and Canada, living on handouts from strangers to spread her message of peace. Her only possessions were a toothbrush, a comb, and a pen, and these little small leaflets she gave out with her message of peace. It's a very cool message of peace. They're very, very universal. And you know, she was great. You know, I loved her. You know, one of the things that comes to mind from there's a book where she retold some of her stories. And there's a woman who, you know, her family had, her kids had grown up, and her husband had died. And she was living in her four-bedroom house, a large four-bedroom house, and she would spend her days kind of cleaning the house, taking care of the house, doing all this stuff, you know, and it's like she was like a slave to this house. And she was telling Peace Pilgrim how unhappy she was, you know, and Peace Pilgrim just said to her, "Well, what do you like to do? What do you actually like to do?" She said, "Oh, I like to swim and I like to sing." And so she just encouraged her to sell her house and to move into one small space, and she moved into like a one bedroom apartment, and she started swimming and singing, and she really loved her life with that all her stuff. Many of us get hooked by greed for information. You know, when I was a child, I looked forward to going to the library every week and spending a few hours there. It was such a treat. You know, when the internet first became available, I was just so delighted. It was like a genie that could magically answer all my questions instantly. But now it's so easy to explore a subject and so much information. There's always more and more, and it's so easy to compulsively link again and again. And often, you know, often we have a feeling of we just haven't gotten enough. You know, how often do we have to tear ourselves away from the devices, or tear our kids away if we have kids? You know, greed for status. You know, sometimes people don't relate to this, you know, but it's really the greed to be seen a certain way, you know, even, you know, wanting people to think I'm a good person, you know, it's still about wanting to look a certain way, wanting to be seen a certain way, the desire to be liked, to be admired, to be important, the need to prove how great we are, you know, all those needs alienate us from other people and from ourselves. You know, wanting to be better than others. You know, we su wanting success. We it can come from a greed for status or from a heartfelt desperation to do something well. You know, you look at the some of the Zen temples that are so intricately, so carefully hand built. You know, some of the woodwork is so well done, and it comes from this aspiration to really be present with the work we do. A desire to look good can come from self-respect or from clinging to be seen a certain way. You know, even in yoga class, even though the teachers repeatedly say, don't compare yourself, people still regularly injure themselves, forcing their bodies to look like someone else in a pose. You know, some of us have a greed for novelty or for experience, living for the next new thing. I know that even on retreat, you know, I still remember, you know, my first 10-day retreat, and I went into my practice discussion, you know, I think it was like the fourth day, And I guess Sharon Salzberg, can you tell me about the 3 month retreat? And I had even set 3 days there. But the new experience, the future, new experiences are great. They're wonderful. They take us out of our routines and patterns, and they let us see aspects of ourselves we might not see. But we can also get caught up in being materialistic about them, in chasing them, in leaning to the future. And sometimes we have what we call FOMO, fear of missing out, the desire to have it all, to not miss anything. And we can do that with anything. I was doing a Buddhist study course, and I was really appreciating it. And but I had to miss one. It was like went over a period, long period of time, but I had to miss one of them. And there was just like this terrible feeling about what was I'm going to miss something. There's something I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss part of it. But we use that kind of energy in so many in crowding our lives, trying to get everything. Sometimes being so busy being, doing, having no time to actually relax and enjoy it. Or sometimes, longer term, we can have these kind of have an ongoing desire that runs us for years. The delusion that we'll be happy if we just fulfill the desire. Maybe just if I find the perfect partner, that will do it. Or the perfect job, or once I graduate college, boy, then I'll be okay. Then I'll be happy. These desires that are long term, but they keep us, keep us from really settling in the present. Even clinging to the desire for awakening can turn into a lack of appreciation for the present moment. And work against itself. And I've seen meditators who are so determined, very, very disciplined, but they're so dour because they're trying so hard, the Buddha said, the practice is good in the Dharma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, and it's here that we need to live our lives. And there's this movement of desire, and if we watch our minds, we can see the actual movement, wanting something to stay, wanting something new to happen, something to go away. I want food. I want distraction. I want sleep. I want to be warm. I want to be cool. It just kind of goes on. I want to be a good meditator. I want to relax. I want something to happen. These unconscious, I mean, they're like right underneath the surface. What this practice does, mindfulness practice, offers us this choice. Desire has an energy, a momentum. When we're mindful of the desire rising, we have a choice. We can move towards the craving, or we can use that energy to move towards freedom. But to have a choice, we need to be able to recognize whether desire is wholesome, useful, or it's unhelpful at the time. And we need to really recognize the difference between craving and aspiration, between striving and aspiration. And what I mean by that is that, for instance, let's say we decide we're going to climb a steep mountain, to get to the top. We can do it, with this attitude of, okay, other people have done it, I can do it too, and an attitude of striving, maybe gritting our teeth, I'm gonna get to the top, and just one step at a time, but really very tight and with a lot of tension, but determination. Or we can do with a lightness of heart, with an attitude of being inspired. Wow, when I get to the top, it's gonna, get to see something really beautiful. And just being inspired by our goal, it feels very, very different. And it might be unpleasant also, even if we have desperation, it might be just physically pretty hard to do it and still have a lot of unpleasant sensations, that the heart is light. That's, craving has a quality of compulsion, tightening, grasping, tension. Aspiration is uplifting, has a lightness of heart, a brightness. So in practice, craving can arise weakly or with really strong force. And as I said, recognizing when we're caught is the first step in being free of it. Have you ever been eating cookies or something similar, and when you're still chewing one, grab the next one? What's happening? We actually miss the full pleasure of eating the first cookie because we're so caught in our desire for more. Or maybe waiting in line. We want to find the shortest line, and then we want the line to move faster. And then we want the person in front of us to get the wallet out faster, to count their pennies faster. When we do finally notice, it's it can be really helpful to use just a very gentle labeling, wanting or desire. And when we label something like that, like some of those desires don't look so pretty, right? Some of those, boy, that's pretty selfish, right? How do we note? Can we note with a kindness, with a gentle quality? This is what the mind does. We're caught by what we were caught by. So the primary instruction in mindfulness is when something like this arises, is to investigate it, to get to know it, learn from it. And if it's really strong emotion, really strong desire, to write it out. How does it feel to want this? So we turn our attention from what we want to what it feels like to want it. For instance, let's say you're craving chocolate. You're sitting there fantasizing the chocolate bar that you have hidden in the house. You turn away your attention away from the chocolate, which is the object, towards how does it feel to want it? That kind of desperate, tight feeling of wanting. Drop into the body, really experience it. Feel it with care. Give it permission to be there. Give it space. How we relate to greed or desire is more important than if it's there. If we can bring a kind attention to it, we're bringing awareness. It's a wholesome state. If we're rejecting it, that's adding aversion to it. So give it room. Give these clingings room to be. This is what the conditioned mind does. And when desire is really strong, you can write it out. And it's like leaving an itch unscratched. You may desperately want to scratch it, but if you just stay with it, just stay with it, it eventually fades away. And same thing happens with a strong desire. You can stay with the wanting until it peaks and eventually fades. Takes a little time and willingness and patience to write it out. None of you, I'm positive that none of you, whatever desire you had this morning is still lingering now. might have come back, but it's not the same exact desire. When we write out a desire, we weaken its hold on us, which can be very empowering to do that. I tend to think of greed and aversion as two sides of the same coin. And Shelley will be talking about aversion tomorrow. Sometimes we're much more tuned into what we want, and other times we're more tuned into what we don't want. But either way, we want things to be different than they are. For instance, we might feel really uncomfortably warm, and we might get ourselves tied up in knots, oh, this is terrible, I'm so hot, and why didn't they fix the air conditioning? Or we might be focused on, oh, I really want to be cool. How do I get cool? How do I get more comfortable? Maybe I should buy a better fan. Or I'll take a shower after sitting and cool off. And we might go back and forth between them, hating the heat and craving the coolness. Are we wanting something, reaching forward? Are we pushing away what's here? But they might both be happening one after the other. But in the moment we notice, one of them's predominating, and that's the one we can pay attention to. Not the one we think we should pay attention to, but whatever's right here. If in the moment we're looking, leaning forward towards the, cooling off, then that's the one we pay attention to, whichever one we notice. And there's no getting it wrong either. It doesn't, as long as you pay attention, it doesn't matter. About 30 years ago, a Dharma teacher retold an experience he had that stayed with me. And he was caught in an unexpected storm and he couldn't reach shelter. And it was a really severe storm, and he found this little tiny overhang of rock, like a little crag, that he could sit under and stay dry, but if he just didn't move, right? If he stretched out his legs, they get soaked. So he had to just sit really still in this little crag. In the hours of sitting there, he found that if his mind started thinking about the future, the food he didn't have on him, he'd just start unconsciously leaning forward and he'd get wet. So he'd come back to the center, and other times he started, regretting how he'd been so stupid and thinking about the past, what he forgot to do, and he'd start leaning back and he'd get wet. And he had hour after hour observing the back and forth of his mind over the hours, getting wet many times. And whether it was so clean and neat, I don't know, but it's left an impression in me. And often, it's come up, and that image has come up during my meditation when my mind's going forward like that, forward and back. And one more thing I want to say about craving. Anytime the mind is not at peace, there's craving involved. So if you're not at peace, you could ask yourself, what is it you want? You're wanting to be different than it is. Now, as we practice by, writing out desire, allowing ourselves to really get to know it, it develops the capacity, it develops a sense of confidence and trust in the moment, a confidence and trust in ourselves. Oh, I can be with this. I can do this. It cultivates a sense of enough. If we're feeling, if we're wanting something and we can't have it, but we're with it, our presence shows up fully in the moment, and it fills that moment with enoughness. Being here is enough. This experience is enough. And by meeting or desires, unfulfilled desires, or reaching for desires, and being able to let them come and go, just come and go, and not grabbing onto them, this confidence gets stronger and stronger. A trust in our ability to meet or experience whatever it is. I really like this definition. The Pali word for confidence or faith is sada, and or sada. It literally means to place your heart upon. And when we place our heart upon the moment, we're wholeheartedly present, fully present. That's a sense of trust. We can trust this moment. We can show up fully, no matter what that moment is. Self-confidence can be defined as the belief in our ability to bring about a successful outcome when faced with a challenge. But what's a successful outcome? We get trapped in having our confidence dependent on how we feel we are accomplishing. If we feel we're doing well, we feel good, right? Oh, I had a good meditation. I'm a good meditator. If we struggle, we might lose confidence. Some of us are particularly hard on ourselves, and then we might feel good and confident when things are going well. If things are hard or we don't think we're doing well, we're critical, judgmental, harsh, and we might lose our motivation. I'm always inspired by something Niels Bohr said. He's a physicist. He said, an expert is a person who has made all the mistakes that can be made in a very narrow field. It takes confidence to be willing to fail again and again. Failing is an integral part of learning. So any moment where, we feel like we're struggling, this is, here I am. I'm bringing my full heart to this moment. This is what struggling is like. This is what, this challenge is like. And when we do that, the practice teaches us to meet our insecurities or worries, anything like that that arises with kindness, any failures with yes, I can meet this. I can get to know this. I have room for it. And when we do that, something in us deeply relaxes. Something in us can be deeply at ease. Lao Tzu, the 6th-century Chinese philosopher, said, "Kindness in words creates confidence." And this includes the kindness in our own inner dialogue. What do we say to ourselves? In this practice, it's not being perfect that creates confidence, but being able to meet our imperfections with clarity, with kindness. In my early practice, I was very inspired by my teachers, by the teachings I read or heard, but I spent a lot of time trying to do it right, trying to get the specific instruction how to pay attention to the breath. And I learned from different teachers, and I was really confused, which one was right. One teacher said, "Oh, you always have to pay attention to the nose." Another one said, "No, pay attention to the belly." And it took me time to trust my own deeper experience, to learn how to best pay attention from within, from my own sense of how I connected with the breath, how I felt the breath, how I was present, not from an outside idea of how I should be. This strengthened my confidence and trust in my ability to practice. It's not that I didn't value my teacher's input, but it had to resonate with my own experience, which is what the Buddha taught. Come and see for yourself. He said, we can develop a confidence grounded in our own experience. And the opposite of faith can be seen as doubt. And it might be doubt in ourselves or in the practice or in the teachings, but a lot of doubt is really very positive and helpful, just like desire. All these things have more than one side. It's wise to say, I don't understand that, and reach out to someone to learn more. Or doubt that says, I don't think I can scale this mountain. Maybe I'll start with an easier one. And as we practice, if for those kind of for the those kind of doubts, we can see for ourselves the practice is leading us to have less greed, less anger, less fear, and we trust that. It leads to clarity. We feel less cut off and disconnected. We can trust that. And that was particularly helpful for me when I began to doubt that the negative thoughts I had in my mind about myself and of others, I started to doubt that they were true. I learned not to trust everything I think, or not to believe everything I think. And I thought a lot of very negative stuff about the world. And I finally started going, oh, is that really true? Is that really true? Is everybody really horrible? Is that really true? But doubt can be a hindrance, especially during meditation. Doubting our ability during meditation, keeps us thinking about it and not actually practicing. If it's a genuine question or a useful doubt, we can say, oh yeah, that's really actually useful. I need to find out. But put it aside for later. Ask a teacher later. Read about it. Talk about it. Reflect about it. But not during meditation. It's not the right time. It's not helpful. The hindrance of doubt during meditation keeps us from fully placing our hearts into the moment. It's speculation just keeps us thinking about the path, and not actually doing it. But if we can recognize it for what it is, the recognition of the hindrance of doubt is already a moment of awareness. We can choose to stop feeding the doubt with our ideas and thinking about it. Another example from my own practice, I was a period where I was studying both Vipassana and Zen at the same time with two different teachers. And I kept wondering, which method's better, which is the right method for me, And when my teacher said, it doesn't matter which one you choose, stick to a single method for 2 years and get good at it. It takes time to develop the skill. Then try something else if you want. Then you can have a real comparison. So I put it aside, and and my meditations became a hell of a lot more peaceful. And we all have the experience of confidence. We all learn to walk. How many times we fall on our bums, before we learn to walk, right? We figured out how to stand up again, now we're all pretty confident in our skill. Even as some of us get older, our bodies may not be so reliable. Maybe we lose our ability to walk or it decreases, but we can be confident in learning to use a cane and walking slower. In meeting what's next as best as we can. In In my youth, I spent many years developing my yoga practice, and I was like really limber and strong, and I felt great about it, and I really valued the strength and balance I felt. But I had an accident, and so much of what I was used to doing just made my injury worse, and I got really, really discouraged and depressed. But fortunately, a friend of mine who's a yoga teacher at the time, she said, "Don't stop doing yoga. Just focus on what you can do." And there wasn't much. It was just a few little things I could do. It allowed me to move, to connect with my body, and to relax into it instead of being stuck in resistance and loss. In this practice, we always practice with where we are, not where we want to be. When practice and life are difficult, we can develop a deep trust in the power of mindfulness, that it's enough to just pay attention to whatever's in front of us. In this body, here, just this moment. And when the mind relaxes and we connect with the simple beauty of our own minds, we can appreciate that without trying to hold on to it. So I think I'll end with the poem by Billy Collins called Dharma. The way the dog trots out the front door every morning without a hat or an umbrella, without any money or the keys to her dog house, it never fails to fill the saucer of my heart with milky admiration. Who provides a finer example of a life without encumbrance? Thoreau in his curtainless hut with a single plate, a single spoon? Gandhi with his staff and his holy diapers? Off she goes into the material world with nothing but her brown coat and her modest blue collar, following only her wet nose, the twin portals of her steady breathing, followed only by the plume of her tail. If only she didn't shove the cat aside every morning and eat all his food. What a model of self-containment she would be. What a paragon of earthly detachment. If only she were not so eager for a rug behind the ears, so acrobatic in her welcomes. If only I were not her God. So thank you, everyone. And enjoy the rest of the practice, next practice period. And if you who'd like to come to the 6:15 Pacific, I'll have a Q&A. It'd be in a different room, so please check the link at the bottom of the schedule. Thank you.